Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
For all food, we had a 1.1% increase between June and July of 22. This led to a 10.9% increase between July of 21 and July of 22.
Looking at the new Consumer Price Index report, USDA economist Mac McLaughlin.
For food at home, we had a 1.4% increase month over month, and this led to a 13.1% year-over-year increase between July of 21 and July of 22. For food away from home, we saw a 0.7% increase between June and July, which led to a 7.6% increase year-over-year between July of 21 and July of 22.
This is Agriculture Today.
Most traders dealing in corn, soybeans, and wheat are probably not too surprised at Friday's USDA crop production report, the first forecast based partially on farmer surveys about expected yields. However, cotton traders may be stunned at what USDA said about cotton production. More on that in a minute. First, for corn, USDA forecasting a 14.4 billion bushel crop, 5% smaller than last year, based partially on a 4% decline in expected harvested acreage. Soybeans, no real surprise there. USDA looking for a record 4.53 billion bushel crop, up 2% from last season, this from record expected yields and 1% more harvested acres. Now to cotton. Most traders were looking for a cotton crop of maybe 15 million bales. USDA's forecast far below anybody's guess at only 12.6 million, down 28% from last season. USDA forecasting a huge amount of abandonment, leaving projected harvested area down by 31%.
That's Gary Crawford in Washington. Let's stay at USDA as we dig a little deeper into the World Ag Supply Demand Estimates Report and the Crop Production Report with a focus for a moment on cotton. Rod Bain reports.
USDA's first look at this year's spring crop production, based in part on first farmer yield surveys, reveals various trends. As Chief Economist Seth Meyer explains, with soybeans,
the current estimate for soybean yields, a record high of 51.9 bushels an acre. I think that was not outside of the range of trade expectations, but not certainly on the high side of it.
The record bean yield also contributes to a projected record high production of over 4.5 billion bushels. Yields for corn were down 1.6 bushels year-over-year, yet at over 175 bushels per harvested acre, that is still the fourth highest yield total on record.
A decent crop, but maybe a little below trend. A little bit of an underperforming crop relative to trend.
Cotton yields also reported an increase of 27 pounds from last year, yet drought-related abandonment of acres led to a significant reduction in production.
Nearly 70% of the Texas cotton area being abandoned, resulting in a pretty big month-over-month cut in what estimated production of that crop is.
And over 1.4 million acre reduction from July.
Nearly 3 million bales lower.
In cotton production. If realized, it would be our nation's lowest cotton production since 2009. Despite the all cotton production forecast down 28% from last year, the lower acreage translates into a higher yield forecast for this year's crop, with yields up 27% from 2021. As for how the USDA forecast compares to market reaction, Meyer notes,
I think that will be a surprise to the market on how small that crop is.
It was USDA's first global supply and demand estimate since this news out of Ukraine earlier this week.
Ongoing agreement with Russia, Ukraine, with Turkey as the moderator of this agreement to ship grain out of some of Ukraine's Black Sea ports.
With the United Nations chartered ship arriving Friday in Ukraine to ship grain from that nation to Africa.
The very good growing conditions for corn within Ukraine, and that corn's largely produced in areas not occupied by the Russians and not in active conflict areas.
So in addition to a projected 5 million metric ton month-over-month increase in Ukraine corn production, USDA forecasts indicate this could lead to
an estimate that they'll increase their corn exports by 3 million metric tons in the coming year.
Thanks, Rod. You know, the 2023 red meat and poultry production forecast, according to USDA, raised on higher beef production, beef forecast raised, reflecting higher expected placements late this year, and based on the calf crop reported in the latest cattle report. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So this is not an exhaustive list, and this is probably very familiar to most of you on the call, but the things that we look at for different cropping systems are things like cropland management, no-till, low-till, cover crops, organic amendments, things like applying enhanced efficiency fertilizer, how you're managing nitrogen.
Kate Zook, Senior Program Analyst at USDA's Office of Energy and Policy on a recent Farm Foundation forum.
On grazing and pasture land, it's things like rotational grazing, legume interseeding, nutrient management. In animal systems, largely we look at two different categories. One is manure management. So how are you managing that manure? Are you using digesters, covering and flaring lagoons, using solid separation, things like that? And then on the feed management side, to target enteric, it's how are you managing that feed? Are you using things that are up and coming like feed additives to reduce those emissions? In the land use change category, we typically talk about things like grass waterways, applying buffers, planting trees on farms, and then in on-farm energy, it's typically things like energy efficiency improvements. So obviously, again, this is not an exhaustive list, but these are the types of on-farm activities that we aim to quantify the greenhouse gas benefits of on those various scales.
There are three scales: national, program, and entity. More on the national scale.
USDA actually works with the Environmental Protection Agency to produce the annual inventory of greenhouse gas emissions and sinks report. We call this the national inventory. And it's a report that covers all the different sectors of the economy. Agriculture is one of those chapters. And USDA actually provides EPA a lot of data to produce that report every year. And that data is on how food is produced and what practices farmers are using. And it comes from a whole bunch of different surveys, largely. And you are probably very familiar, USDA issues a lot of different surveys. There's the Ag Census, the Agricultural Resources Management Survey, or ARMS, the National Animal Health Monitoring Survey, NAMS. You know, none of those are specifically focused on conservation adoption. There's one exception, that's the Conservation Effects Assessment Project, or CEEP, that's very focused on what conservation practices farmers are applying. But in general, you know, these surveys aren't issued every year. And we do this balance of looking at what questions in those surveys can tell us something about conservation adoption on farm. And usually in those surveys, we can pick a few that say something about how that food's being produced and the benefits that that's providing for climate. So there's questions about cover crop adoption, for example, or manure management systems that are being used. And we piece that together and package that data to EPA. That's applied into large models that are state of the science, and we produce these giant estimates for every year what those emissions profiles are. There is a lot of room for improvement here. If you look at the graph on the right, this is the history of the trends of emissions from the agriculture sector from 1990 to 2020. And when I look at this, the big takeaway for me is like, there's not much of a trend. You know, it's pretty flat. And there are many reasons for this. But one is that we're not doing a great job of actually picking up those conservation practices and reflecting them in this inventory. We know anecdotally that a lot of these conservation practices are being applied, but we can do a better job of being more frequent in terms of reporting trends and also reporting some of those newer technologies that we're not doing a great job of, such as enhanced efficiency fertilizers, biochar, pasture management, feed management. So there's a real effort within USDA now to shore up our ability to do this national level reporting on a more accurate way.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
So AMS called the Fed cattle market through Thursday in Kansas at about 140, up about $4 on the week.
Kansas State livestock economist Dr. Glenn Tonzer.
Flip over to feeder cattle. It's a little bit more steady, a little bit up, depending on what weight class you'd quote. They called the Pratt market, as I said, steady to $3 up. Two lots, just to give some context to our listeners. 83 head that weighed 729 pounds. No comment. Steers was 182. A little bit heavier lot, weighing 876, went for 175. Those that are tracking those would be up a little bit compared to certainly 2 or 3 weeks ago. When you flip this over to the board, so the futures market, the parallel information, there's an August contract trading for both live and feeder cattle currently. August live cattle's 140, up about $2 on the week, so same trend direction as we saw in cash. And then feeder cattle, August contract was flat at 179. When I pause there, if I go any further, I think we're starting to see a little bit of spillover specific on the live cattle, fed cattle market. Hogs have been rallying. stallion. There's discussion about ASF in China, some optimism on this side about potentially exporting more. We could belabor that more in a separate time if you want, but I think that actually hit the cattle market a little bit this week in the form of new news, if you like, as well as some confirmed, maybe we finally, I've been saying this for a while, turn the corner on market-ready cattle. There's some support price-wise on the fed cattle complex.
Another number that Tonser watches closely, slaughter numbers.
Well, the volumes continue to be high. So the initial estimates for the current week through Saturday is for 647,000 head of cattle to be harvested. That would be up from 636 last week. And it's worth noting, you know, here we are now, and year-to-date cattle slaughter is up 1.2% compared to the year before. Yours truly has continued to be surprised. We've kept that up, mainly because of the number of cows and subsequently what we thought was going to be the feedlot inventories for quite some time. We thought earlier in 2022 we would turn the corner and have lower processing volumes. That remains just an inevitable outcome, but the drought coupled with some other forces have pulled cattle forward, and that continues to be the story. But I think, and I will readily admit, I've been saying this for a couple months, I think we're to the end of that. By the time we get to Labor Day in particular, we might be turning the story on Q3, Q4. Harvest volumes will be notably lower than they were the same quarters in 2021.
And where are we when it comes to returns for feeders?
This is referring to the feedlot returns that we keep up on our Ag Manager website. I update them once a month, as we've talked about before. And they're projected returns for cattle leaving each month. And the last update was done as of August 5th. And the turning point is around Labor Day or October. So negative returns or break-even returns, small losses, are projected for cattle leaving here in August as well as September. But then starting in October all the way through currently April of 2023 is the furthest out month that my projections look at, are all positive returns. And real narrowly, the months of November through January. So cattle would be leaving feed yards. The returns are north of $100. That's the positive projected return I'm talking about. It's worth noting how those notably improved margins are developing. One is these projections show a lower cost of gain, so corn prices and the like coming back some, and moreover, output prices. So the price you're going to get for your finished animal is projected to go up notably for animals leaving the yard. These are projections, right? We got a long ways to go till November to see if these are realized, but the market is signaling currently that things are going to improve for the cash operators, at least in the feedlot space.
And finally, Tonser looks a little deeper into the boxed beef market.
So Friday morning, USDA called choice boxed beef at 263. It was off about $2 from the Friday before. They called select at 240, up $1 from, again, the week before, the prior Friday. So not a lot of movement in the boxed beef space. You put a bow on that, as I said, not a lot of movement boxed beef, not much movement feeder cattle, a little bit on the, you know, cash in particular, live cattle side of things. But overall, it's definitely a calmer week than some others we've had.
Kansas State Livestock Economist Dr. Glenn Tonser. I'm Tony St. James. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The program had a national level engagement for a number of years. In more recent years, that has been left to the individual states to promote that, and they have done so.
He's talking about the Grazing Lands Conservation Initiative. Natural Resources Conservation Service Associate Chief Lewis Aspey.
We have rekindled that in the purpose of the funding opportunity that we have provided to reinvigorate that program. So we're putting $12 million out there via a contribution agreement arrangement. Our partners that are successful with that would be working with our private landowners out there. And I think overall it's a recognition of the importance of privately owned grasslands nationally. It accounts for about 30% of the land across the country right now, the national landscape. So you can see the importance of it and just the scale.
Private landowners, field staff, public, private entities, all making up collaborative grazing land conservation efforts.
There would be a grazing plant that would be completed with a conservationist walking the land with that private landowner, and this is completely voluntary. They would walk out there, look at the land, and at the end result of that, a product would be an evaluation and a plan for the grazing opportunity, the grazing lands that are out there. It could identify practices that would be beneficial for that, perhaps rotational grazing, re-looking at the soil health of the property, the health of the grass, but it would be dependent on that land and the unique circumstances that that producer faces with their operation. The eligibility for this opportunity, nonprofit organizations, farm and rancher organizations, state and local conservation government agencies, ag extension services, Native American tribal governments, federally recognized and or other than federally recognized, land grant universities, including 1890 and 94 land grant institutions, Hispanic serving institutions, or other minority serving institutions, such as historically black college or universities, tribal colleges or universities, or Asian American and Pacific Islander serving institutions. So it's a fairly broad range of eligible entities here.
Natural Resources Conservation Service Associate Chief Lewis Aspey. Let's turn from grazing lands conservation to CPI.
Year-over-year consumer inflation in July was 8.5%, down from 9.1% in June. The month-over-month inflation was 0%, though that was largely the result of a 4.6% drop in energy prices. Roger Cryan, American Farm Bureau Federation chief economist, says inflation remains a concern.
Food prices were almost 11% above last year and up over 1% just in the 1 month, and that'll continue to be an issue as demand is high and will remain high, and farmers around the world are challenged by things like drought and high fuel and fertilizer prices, and not to mention the war in the Ukraine. The Federal Reserve Bank pumped a lot of dollars into the economy in 2020 and 2021, and now the Fed is raising interest rates and selling assets to soak up some of those dollars. But we're going to see headline inflation in the 5% to 9% range well into 2024.
Cryan says the economy remains strong, but the market remains weary.
Job vacancies are a little bit lower than they were a couple months ago, but they're still way above pre-2021 levels. There's 10 million job vacancies in the U.S. economy right now. That means there's still a lot of demand in the economy. But we have a strong narrative in the market that says if the Fed raises rates, recession will happen. And that narrative is driving an overreaction, and that overreaction could drive a continuing recession.
Cryan says there are some silver linings for farmers and ranchers.
A recession doesn't help farmers, but commodity prices are still relatively high, and if fuel and fertilizer prices keep dropping, that would be a big help. And the Fed's serious attack now, finally, on inflation, I think, is helping to restore faith in the market that inflation isn't going to be a long-term issue. So we're already seeing long-term interest rates start to drop, which is very helpful for farmers when they're looking to invest. And short-term interest rates will come down once inflation is beat, though that could take a couple of years.
Michael Clements, Washington.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We coordinate for three topics for all of USDA.
Kate Zook is Senior Program Analyst at USDA's Office of Energy and Policy.
And those topics are climate change, environmental markets, and renewable energy policy. So a lot of the themes of environmental impact reporting that we're talking about today are interwoven in the things that we do in our office.
And she talks about climate change and greenhouse gas benefit reporting.
So in the U.S., ag contributes about 11% of the overall greenhouse gas emissions. And those emissions come from a variety of different sources. The largest source, this is surprising to some folks, is the category that we call agricultural soil management. And in that category is actually things like how we apply nitrogen and fertilizer. And fertilizer is a large source of nitrous oxide, which is a very high global warming potential emission. So soil management, we also have things like enteric fermentation, cowburps, manure management, rice cultivation, urea fertilization, liming, field burning. So what we aim to do is look at all those sources, figure out how we could reduce those emissions. And what makes agriculture a bit unique compared to other sectors is that we can also sequester carbon in the soil to reduce emissions while continuing to provide products and benefits for the broader economy. So that really plays into this idea of producing goods with a better environmental impact.
And breaks down these accounting systems using carbon markets as an example.
So when we talk about an accounting system, it's not just quantification and measurement. It's also monitoring and reporting and verification to create this system that allows us to feel really credible about what we're reporting. And typically that's referred to as MMRV, measurement, monitoring, reporting, and verification. And in carbon markets, these systems are kind of set up by a variety of different registries. And so the registries, and I have three across the top here, American Carbon Registry, Climate Action Reserve, and VERA, the Verified Carbon Standard. They issue protocols or sort of like the recipe of how you can generate offsets from different practices in agriculture that can reduce emissions. So things like grassland practices, livestock practices, et cetera. So there are a lot of protocols out there actually that could be used today. There are about 35 protocols out there, but 25 of them have actually never been used, like never generated an offset. So why is that? There are a lot of reasons. Agricultural projects tend to be small in terms of the number of offset tons they generate compared to other project types. But they still need to go through all the same hoops for verification and reporting, resulting in high transaction costs. Also, because there are multiple registries out there offering different protocols for the same project type, there is some confusion in the marketplace. If you're a producer, you know, you're kind of looking at all this saying, what's going to give me the best bang for a buck? What should I enter into? And as a result, there's limited demand. You know, there's a certain price point that farmers typically need to enter into these market schemes to make them pencil out. And at the current price point in the voluntary market, you know, these projects tend to, again, be a little more expensive than other project types like forestry, industrial, and landfill projects. And so they're hard to compete. And so because of all of this, agricultural offsets in the voluntary market only make up about 2% of that market share. So in the end of the day, you know, farmers aren't ultimately seeing the benefits of that market. And all of this could change. You know, if there's a new market driver, if, you know, there's a new protocol that comes online that allows for scale and aggregation, you know, certainly this could change. However, you know, to date, we haven't really seen that.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Yeah, overall, it's been surprising, and I think it depends on what market channel you talk about.
K-State livestock economist Dr. Glenn Tonser.
And I usually describe the beef market channel and actually all meat market channels as there's three legs to that stool. One is the foreign market, so export demand, and then two domestically. Think grocery store for at home and the restaurants for away from home. The Meat Demand Monitor Project that's based here at K-State, Beef and Pork Checkoff supported, gives us insight on the two domestic channels. And the July numbers have recently been released. And to answer your question, it depends on which domestic market channel, what the demand story is. So retail, again, think grocery store demand, is actually up for every category I look at, except for plant-based patties. So ribeye steak, ground beef, pork chops, bacon, chicken breast, those categories we're always looking at. The month of July had stronger grocery store demand than in June, so that is good to answer your question. But the story is basically the flip when we look at food service. So away from home demand, all the meals, the willingness to pay for meals that we look at, were down compared to June, with the exception of ribeye steak meals, and they were basically flat. It was like within 2 cents of the same, so there's no change. If you put a bow around that, and I know I just threw a lot of information at the listeners, I think it's, again, ongoing evidence that consumers are tightening their belts, a little bit less of food away from home demand. That's one of the easiest things to do. You know, there's at least half and maybe even three-fourths of the country that's experiencing a net pay decline as inflation's up and wages haven't kept up. So adjustments have to be made in household finances. And I think away from home food demand in general and meat demand in particular here is one of the categories where we're seeing that.
The numbers do provide interesting insight.
The Meat Demand Monitor allows us to do a deeper dive. I just gave the channel kind of summary, but exactly what changes are they making? So over 70% indicate they are making a change, but the three changes that are most prevalent, and there's more people than in the past saying they're doing this, is nearly a third of respondents in our July survey say they're buying the same thing, but they're just buying less of it. So they're buying the same cut, brand, package, whatever, they're just getting a lower volume. So think going home with two packages instead of three, that kind of thing. A separate 20% are saying they're buying different cuts. So maybe instead of ribeye, sirloin, or maybe instead of 90% lean, it's 80, or maybe instead of bacon, it's ham. And then some, almost a fourth, are saying smaller packages. So maybe a 12-ounce package instead of 16 and so forth. Yes, that's all geeky, but it is important to understand those adjustments. And it's also important to understand there's still a desire for meat. So we still have over 70% that indicate they regularly consume meat products. An additional 13% are flexitarians. So the vast majority of the U.S. public still has a strong interest in meat, but they're responding to the prices. And I just try to give us some flavor of how they're making those adjustments.
And on export demand.
Yeah, so beef in particular continues to have a really good story. We've had multiple months with over $1 billion, and that is with a B, dollars in sales on individual months. The month of June marked the 15th consecutive month that we've had year-over-year export demand growth. So that's foreign demand for U.S. beef is growing year-over-year. That is a great thing. Keep in mind we don't send the same products through these three market channels. I'm not the first one to use this phrase, but I use it because it makes the point. We sell everything but the moo. And on the hog side, we sell everything but the oink. I mean, there's a market for everything, but sometimes that's a market in Japan. Sometimes it's one in Mexico City. Sometimes it's one here in Manhattan, Kansas. And even if it's in Manhattan, Kansas, it might be different in the restaurant versus the grocery store. So understanding product level mix is also really important here. But certainly on the beef side, there's been additional support from foreign buyers. That is one of the reasons, I believe, you're having higher fed cattle prices.
So from export beef demand to export pork demand.
So export demand for pork has waned. Specifically, June demand was down 17% compared to the same period a year before. And I think it's important to remember the Chinese demand for U.S. pork has taken a step back as they, at least in the past, were recovering from ASF. I alluded to this a little bit earlier, is there's some renewed discussion about ASF in China. There's a lot of uncertainty and mixed signals and so forth in that comment. This side, right, I think the U.S. Midwest in particular, there's some enhanced optimism that maybe that's going to boost pork exports in the future. I'm not sitting here wishing disease on any country. Don't take the comment that way. But that would alter global demand for pork from exports from a U.S. supply perspective. That's worth watching here as 2022 concludes.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
For the U.S. economy as a whole, the rate of inflation last month went down to zero. The price of gas, for example, dropped by almost 8%. But while the rate of price hikes for some items slowed down...
Food did not.
No, it did not. Agriculture Department economist Matt McLaughlin says that according to the Consumer Price Index covering July...
For food at home, we saw a 1.4% increase.
That July hike in grocery store food prices leading to...
A 13.1% year-over-year increase between July of 21 and July of 22.
The highest 12-month increase in grocery store food prices since 1979. For beef lovers, perhaps some good news. Retail beef prices actually dropped in July, but only by 0.1%, leaving beef prices still about 3.5% higher than this time a year ago. Pork costing about 7.5% more than a year ago. Poultry, 16.5%. Gary Crawford, Washington.